This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Today's show is How to Prevent Heart Disease, Cancer, and Chronic Diseases with our expert preventive health physician, Dr. Duke Johnson. When health study results are announced, the news feeds us sketchy, piecemeal results with little attention to the quality or limitations of the studies. Radio and TV thrives on the diet of the week and sensationalism. It's no wonder that Americans are confused about what to do to be healthier. But research is becoming increasingly clear that there is a common denominator to heart disease, cancer, diabetes, arthritis, and other chronic diseases. Dr. Duke Johnson, author of The Optimal Health Revolution, shares with us what that commonality is and how it can guide us in preventing chronic disease. Dr. Johnson, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Wonderful to be with you, Dr. Bricky.
I've been finding more and more researchers citing inflammation as the common denominator of chronic diseases, but it wasn't until I read your book that it all fit together for me. Tell us how C-reactive protein led you to conclude that inflammation is the common denominator.
Well, it was really rather interesting in noticing that C-reactive protein, which is an inflammatory molecule, was the widest molecule in research and was found to be associated with many risk factors that we had commonly associated for years with chronic disease, such as elevated cholesterol, insulin resistance, obesity, etc. Well, finally, in 2004, I wanted to find out if there was research that would point to the fact that C-reactive protein or other inflammatory molecules associated with the immune system were elevated with every risk factor that I had taught for almost 20 years in preventive medicine and was able to find it. And that was a special moment for me because then I realized that that consistency was the link that held everything together, that all of the risk factors we'd ever taught were also associated with inflammation.
And when you go for your annual physical and they do the usual lipid panel, you need to ask your doctor, hey, also do a C-reactive protein, and they can easily add it. But usually, if you don't ask for it, you don't get it.
No, you're absolutely right. And I have to admit that there is a little bit of a question as far as the role that that fits right now. And the reason is because C-reactive protein is just one of the inflammatory markers that our immune system puts into the blood. There are scores of them, actually. It's just that C-reactive protein is the most studied of all inflammatory markers. And so that research is what opened the door for us to look at other inflammatory markers and what role they have. And so it does give a little bit of a good indicator generally. Now, of course, it's going to be elevated if somebody had a recent cold or a flu, but if they haven't been sick recently and their C-reactive protein is consistently high, they're in a chronically elevated inflammatory state, which isn't good.
You've got me curious. What's the second best measure?
There are several of them. There are interleukin-1, there's a whole array of interleukins. There's just an article that came out recently in Cell Metabolism in April of last month where there's CXC ligand 5, which seems to be associated with maybe the link between obesity and insulin resistance. I mean, there is a plethora of inflammatory molecules, and the door has really been swung wide open to find out which inflammatory markers are the key ones to investigate. But right now, readily available, you can get C-reactive protein quite readily.
Can you describe for us what inflammation is using the example of cardiovascular disease?
Yeah, what was interesting, in 1995, researchers found that for some reason, C-reactive protein was found to be elevated in people who had heart attacks. And they really didn't understand, is that just simply an association or a cause? And that's really been the debate since. What's C-reactive protein is a marker of the immune system, and it really would make sense that if your immune system is going to try to repair a cut in your skin or a sliver under your skin, that it should really be involved with trying to repair heart disease and blood vessels that have damage to them. Well, the real debate has been ever since, is inflammation a cause or is it a result? But from really my perspective of global health and our experiences and what I lay out in the book very clearly is that it is really both a cause and a result of a disease once it's established.
So your body is saying, hey, there's an emergency here. We need to send out the white blood cells and other troops and deal with this emergency. And in the process of chronically doing that, does a lot of damage.
You hit it perfectly. In fact, the analogy that I give is that our, let's say our body is a house. Our immune system is a really complex system, but let's just say it's a lion designed to protect the house, and it's looking for bacteria, viruses, etc., which I would denote as being a mouse entering the house. Well, the way the lion is designed is that it's laying down, crouching, looking for mice. And when a mouse comes in, it rises up, it gets incredibly angry, it races over, it kills the mouse, and then it lies back down again. Well, our industrialized lifestyle is entering into our body substances that are in essence like kicking the lion. The lion sees it as being foreign. It irritates the lion, but the lion doesn't know what to kill. It wants to kill something. It doesn't know what to kill. And because it's angry, it's running around basically the house, knocking over lamps, tables, looking for something to kill. It's causing damage, and it wasn't designed to be up and walking around.
And these insults are air pollution, trans fats,
you got it,
junk food, all kinds of things.
You got it. And in fact, that's where it just led me to the conclusion that therefore I must be able to find research where I can find inflammatory molecules associated with high fructose corn syrup, herbicides, pesticides, etc. And by golly, I was able to find it, and that just made perfect sense, and that's why I put it in the book. In fact, also too, my perspective is that I have patients from really 30 different countries around the world who live in their countries with their cultures and lifestyles, and every time they industrialize, when they industrialize, chronic diseases go up immediately.
That's an amazing observation. We often think of, well, Japan or Okinawa or Mediterranean countries are doing better than we are, but creeping industrialization is happening there, and they're becoming more and more like Americans.
Absolutely. In fact, you mentioned Japan. I have a graph that I actually put into the book from the Ministry of Health of Japan with the major causes of death. And what you see, you hear a lot about Okinawa, but when you look at the average citizen in Japan, the graph shows the major causes of death for residents of Japan. And before World War II, the major causes of death were tuberculosis, infectious diseases, and heart disease and cancer were very low. Immediately, and you can see on the graph, immediately after World War II, infectious diseases go down as major causes of death, and heart disease, cancer immediately start rising.
I guess we can call this the McDonald's effect.
You bet. And you know what? It has occurred in every country. It's the same pattern. I have, in essence, that graph on 30 different countries. It's the same pattern in every country. The only thing that differs is the year they began. For example, China began in around 1990, but they have risen faster than it ever rose in the West.
So again, it's food, it's pollution, it's stress, it's all the traffic jams.
Well, yeah, and you know, what's interesting is that, for example, we used to think that polyunsaturated fats that came from corn oil, and having corn oil was really cheap and it would sit on shelves for a long time if we hydrogenated it, like you're saying, making the trans fats. We knew that polyunsaturated fats were good in the 50s or 60s, but what we didn't know is that there are good polyunsaturated fats and bad ones. The good ones are omega-3, the bad ones are omega-6, and corn oil fits into that category of omega-6. So partially hydrogenated corn oils and high fructose corn syrup, etc., those are inflammatory, and what they have a tendency to do is increase inflammation.
Going back to heart disease, can you describe step by step what happens that causes blood vessels to be inflamed?
Yes, when there are many different stimuli that in essence cause assaults to the inner lining of blood vessels. And for example, hypertension or components within cigarette smoke or et cetera. And when there is a damage or an irritant to the lining of a wall, your body naturally sends in the immune system to go try to repair that damage. And there's a whole crescendo of molecules involved in our immune system that go in to try to repair the wall, just like they try to repair our skin and leave a scar. Those inflammatory molecules collect at really high levels, and part of that whole process that your body uses to impact and use as a repair are cholesterol molecules. But, you know, they're almost a result of the original damage that occurs. So there's a high level inflammatory molecule, scars are laid down, but if the offense isn't stopped, body continues that progression, and the wall gets thicker and thicker and thicker until finally you have an atherosclerotic plaque.
With arthritis, we can literally see the inflammation. How does inflammation work with diabetes?
The mechanism was not known for a long time, but just in reference, almost everything that we have seen as far as literature has come out for a long time points in that direction. Let me just tell you, I made reference a little bit to that CXC ligand 5 molecule that was just found recently. Among people who are obese, they have a tendency to have an inflammatory molecule within the fat cells itself that rise. And it's at CXCL5. Well, as it rises in the blood, then insulin resistance also begins to rise as well. And so there was a research study that came out April 8th in Cell Metabolism, and what they showed is that when they blocked that receptor, insulin resistance went down.
Hmm.
So there's a direct connection, and the authors even conclude that there appears to be a direct connection between inflammation and ultimate development of insulin resistance. In addition to that, is that I have in the book 7 risk factors for development of insulin resistance, and all of them are associated with increased inflammation. So I didn't know the molecule, and CXC ligand 5 might be just one of those inflammatory molecules. Cigarette smoking leads to insulin resistance. High fat diets leads to insulin resistance, etc., besides obesity. And so what I do is that all of those behaviors that are associated with development of type 2 diabetes result in the disease. So I knew it was an inflammatory molecule. I didn't know which one. Obviously, this is one of them, but I'm sure there are others. And so what I point to in the book is that we all need to do is reduce inflammation, and that's how we reduce chronic disease, and that's the whole emphasis of the book. How do we reduce that chronic inflammation?
And I think the beauty of what you're doing is it says there's literally dozens of things that contribute to inflammation. And you don't have to be perfect and have the perfect diet and the perfect lifestyle. Anything you do with any one of those contributors helps, almost like a baby step. And the more that you do, the more it's going to help reduce the inflammation and prevent these chronic diseases.
You know, you've hit it perfectly. I'm not perfect, and I don't mean to portray that I'm perfect, but I can tell you I follow about 95% of what I do, and I love chocolate chip cookies, and I'm going to eat chocolate chip cookies. But in essence, the rest of my life, what I take in 7 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables every day. I have a tendency to use a lot of omega-3 in my diet. I supplement to make sure that I can help reduce inflammatory molecules as much as possible, et cetera, et cetera. It's our whole lifestyle. It's not just one thing. And when I see books that come out or fads that come out that just talk about all you need to do is this one thing, it just drives me nuts. That's what led me to write the book. It's not just one thing. It's reduction of inflammation with our whole lifestyle. But everything we do knocks that inflammation down if we know what to do.
Well, you have an advantage over the rest of us in that I don't think the Girl Scouts are selling chocolate chip cookies lately. So.
Well, my wife makes great chocolate chip cookies in a reasonably healthy way, actually. She uses the best type of ingredients that actually include canola oil that has omega-3 to help reduce inflammation. So even then, although it's got sugar, this straight sugar, they actually reasonably healthy.
I know, and you're using the dark chocolate, so it's...
There you go. Now you're talking.
One of the things you emphasize is foods, and like a lot of people, you talk about fresh fruits and vegetables, and you also emphasize organic whenever possible, and a balance of carbs and fats and proteins. Is there any difference between what you advocate and the Mediterranean diet?
You know, it's actually reasonably close, and the reason for that is because what the true Mediterranean diet is really one that probably came from, best described today, from the Isle of Crete. I've been to a lot of Mediterranean countries, and you know, they eat very similarly to what we eat in the U.S. today, but a true Mediterranean diet was one that would be high in fish and have lots of fruits and vegetables as well as olive oil. All of those are anti-inflammatory, and when you really try to get a definition of what is a true Mediterranean diet, people like to stick in their favorite things, and they like to talk about and emphasize more of the wine, etc. But it's really truly those things that are anti-inflammatory that make the Mediterranean so good.
Do your recommendations differ any from Dr. Barry Sears's zone diet?
My understanding, his emphasis really is to, I have to admit I haven't read his books to any great degree, but my understanding is that he tries to get away from a little bit more of carbohydrates and promote protein intake more, which I really have shied away from the emphasis on percentages of carbs, because I really haven't found that to be as dangerous. When you think about the role that carbohydrates have played in the Far East, for example, the vast majority of the intake of the carbohydrates and of the diet in the Far East have been carbohydrates with rice. But chronic diseases were not a problem in the Far East until we industrialized, and they industrialized.
Possibly some of his movement away from the carbohydrates as Americans are getting so fat and eating so many calories that that's a way to help with weight loss.
Well, and it could be. It's just that what I find, and I can't really comment much on his work, and I don't mean to sound negative. It's just that I feel kind of strongly that the treating carbohydrates like a swear word is wrong on the other side. And the reason for that is that complex carbohydrates have extremely valuable ingredients. For example, complex carbohydrates have been shown to help reduce insulin resistance. And so I can certainly understand getting away from simple sugars and candy bars, and especially carbohydrates in the form that have no fiber. But an organic, multi-grain, highly complex fiber cereal or bread, they're not bad. They're not bad at all. And they provide a lot of nutrients we all need.
So bottom line is both of you are about balance, and he would set the balance a little higher on protein, a little heavier on the complex carbohydrates. But
yeah, exactly. And it has to do really truly with my perception of global health, because I have a lot of customers that are in India and Asia and Japan and China, and obesity and chronic diseases were never a problem for centuries. It only became a problem after about 1950 in the Far East.
And like a lot of people, you talk in detail about the problems with processed food and junk food and trans fats and, for a lot of people, high salts. But you also talk about high fructose corn syrup, which I'm only starting to see a lot of publicity about. Tell us what the big problem is with that.
I have some research in the book that points to the fact that I've found some literature that would point to the fact that it does increase inflammation. And so though it may be a nice sweetener, it may taste good, it might make sports drinks taste more enjoyable, there's an increased risk of inflammation that may occur. I've done some work with athletes who were not using sports drinks and then began using them and started having some joint discomforts, and they were stopped immediately. Now, I can't 100% state and place blame anywhere. It wasn't a careful study, but their experience wasn't a surprise to me at all.
Does Gatorade have the high fructose corn syrup?
You know, I really don't. I haven't done a full study of all of the sports drinks. I know it's just a common ingredient. When I've gone into grocery stores and look at ingredients, in fact, everywhere I've traveled in the world, I have our interpreters go with me into stores, and literally manufacturers of processed food use the same ingredients because they're inexpensive and they last on a shelf a long time.
We'll get back to Dr. Johnson in just a moment. Note how old you feel now. You will soon feel a lot younger after hearing Dr. Bricky. That's how I'm usually introduced when I give a keynote address. We are brainwashed with limiting beliefs about aging. As America's preeminent anti-aging psychologist, I bring good news for a change. A change in how you view aging, and I do it with a good helping of humor. In short, I help audiences learn the mental game for living longer, healthier, and happier. But I'm not satisfied with people just acquiring information and having a feel-good time. I have people adopt healthier beliefs on the spot and lock them in for lifelong benefits. I also like to stay and do breakout sessions, consulting, and individual coaching at no additional cost. When your organization or business needs a speaker, have them check out my demo video at anti-aging-speaker.com. That's anti-aging-speaker.com. And give me a call. My phone number is on all my websites. And now back to Dr. Johnson. I'm curious, what's your take on the raw food movement? Where do they have it right in a place that they're getting into some difficulty?
I'm sorry, but when you say the term raw food, can you describe that for me a little bit? I'm not sure about that terminology.
Not cooking any foods over, I think it's 110 degrees.
I have to admit I haven't looked into that a great deal, but I do know that we can get to extremes because, for example, lycopene, which has been shown to reduce the risk of four cancers and it's found in red fruits and vegetables, it is actually pretty well bound in tomatoes and is released with cooking and heat. And so you'll get higher levels of lycopene in tomato juice and tomato soup or tomato pastes than you're going to get from tomatoes. And we've actually checked lycopene levels on people from all over the world. And what's fascinating is that when the Italians come in and we evaluate our Italians, they always have high lycopene levels.
Mm-hmm. So particularly for tomatoes, heating really adds to the food value.
The cooking actually releases up those phytonutrients. Now, I'm not advocating by any way burnt foods, et cetera, because then you increase the risk of carrying carcinogens into the food. But cooking in and of itself, steaming in and of itself, isn't necessarily, from the literature I've seen, as dangerous. There might be a whole field of science that somehow I've bypassed, but I think with anything else, that a reasonable amount of heating and steaming of vegetables, softening them, isn't going to be tremendously damaging.
One of the things I now do when I go to the grocery store since reading your book is when I look at a loaf of bread, is this whole grain or is this multigrain? Can you explain the difference?
A lot of manufacturers have actually kind of played a little bit of a game with that. They realize that people are interested in grains, and so what they'll do is they'll take out the main kernels and the main nutritional value of the grain before they make their bread, and they know that multigrain is something that is a term that people are attracted to. So what they'll still do is they'll use two different grains, take out the nutritional component out of two grains, make the bread, which has very little nutritional value, call it multigrain, and people are excited thinking that that's healthy. And in reality, the term you want to look for is whole grain. Because a bread, for example, or a complex carbohydrate made with whole grains are going to be the ones that contain the nutritional values.
Amazing. Big specialty for you is supplements. And you talk about some of the myths, like we Americans think that if some is good, more must be better. And one of the things that was kind of an eye-opener for me is you say be very careful with herbs, and especially multiple herbs. Can you tell us about that?
It really gets down to where has research been done. What I truly always want to do is be, in essence, a voice for sanity in this whole issue, because it seems that there's a real polarization. In one sense, you have the medical community that almost tries to portray supplementation as evil. On the other hand, you have people who believe in it who, in essence, say that the more is better, and so let's take unlimited amounts, which is crazy in its own right as well. So I try to be a rational voice here to point out what is the science behind what is solid, beneficial, and yet staying away from toxic, dangerous levels. And one of those areas are that some supplement companies feel that if I put in one herb in my supplement, then therefore 10 herbs are better. And there isn't research to show the safety of herbal components in multiplicity. And there haven't been studies done, and you can run the risk of running into, in essence, interactions among the herbs, because most of our medications came from plants originally. And there are components within plants that have ability to change and affect our health. And so if you start, it'd be like saying, well, let's take these 10 medicines together. It's just as crazy.
If somebody is just taking one herb, what are the top six or so herbs in terms of how well they've been studied and how confident we can be about them doing what they're supposed to do?
You know, that's a good question, and I have to admit I haven't done a list of I couldn't come up with a list of what are the top 10 herbs as far as studies are concerned. But if you ask in general, particular herbs, have they been well studied, I could probably respond pretty quickly. But not in a list form, sorry.
Okay. Are there any that you're especially concerned about?
Certainly some of those that have a tendency to be associated with some of the weight loss products. You know, I mean, we knew for years that ephedra, mawang, which was used in herbal products to help reduce weight loss, also increased abnormal heart rhythms. Well, bitter orange, for example, you can go into health foods today and obtain bitter orange, which is an herb that can stimulate similar rhythms, abnormal rhythms as well. So just because it's an herb or just because it's a plant doesn't mean it's safe by any means. And, you know, poisonous mushrooms and heroin and cocaine are from plants, and they're not safe for you either. So we have to have a rational approach to herbs like you would anything else.
Do you have a take on Woodia?
My take on it is, when I look at the true scientific research that's been done, there is a paucity of research, especially in relation to studies done with humans. There's a lot of anecdotal stories that run around, but when I check databases, scientific databases, to really see, have there been double-blind controlled studies looking at the benefits per se, I haven't been able, at least the last time I looked, which was several months ago, I hadn't been able to find some real good studies. And I think that right now the hoopla is much greater than the reality at this point.
We're talking with Dr. Duke Johnson, author of The Optimal Health Revolution. And it's a book that's extremely well documented, but very readable, and really integrates the whole idea of how to stay healthy and what inflammation is about. Your website is drdukejohnson.com.
And that's correct.
You're also medical director for Nutrilite, which is a, among other things, a supplement company. And I would just note that Nutrilite, you told me it produces $3 billion a year in sales, but isn't well known as such because it's a subsidiary of Amway, and virtually all of its sales are through Amway distributors.
Right, or through their websites per se. Nutrilite, as far as we know, is the oldest supplement manufacturer in North America and maybe the world. They're celebrating their 75th year this year and are in 50 different countries. The Nutrilite company owns its own fields and grows a tremendous amount of what they put into their supplements. And so it's a wonderful company. It's just that it is not well known because they haven't done mass marketing.
Okay. And if you wanted to know more about the company, the site is Nutrilite.com, Nutrilite.com.
Right.
And you told me you just got your website up. What's on it?
What I wanted to do is, in essence, there are so many books out there. I wanted to explain partially my motivation as to why I wrote the book. I'm just deal with fads all the time, and a lot of people have made a lot of money and done a lot of things with fads that just really irritate me, because some fads are potentially negative to our health. And finally, I just got to a point where I thought, you know, I want to be a rational voice. I want to be someone who presents really good science, and that's why I put almost 900 scientific references in the book, but yet at the same time can find kind of some common balance and really teach true preventive medicine. And true prevention really begins prior to conception, ideally, but in childhood, throughout life. There's lots of things we can do, and most people don't know what to do. And so I wanted to explain that on the website, tell a little bit about the book, and just who I am.
And I think the book does a wonderful job of being very balanced and very reasoned. I want to get back to supplements. One of the things you talked about was be very careful with Ayurvedic supplements because of heavy metals. And you said there's a history to that.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. The history is that Ayurvedic medicine comes from the Far East, and the belief at the time was that heavy metals were actually had healing powers. And I don't know if you know that there were some famous emperors who, in essence, one in particular in the, I believe it was the Qin Dynasty, who wanted to live forever, and so he had a river made of mercury that I actually saw a show on this not too long ago, where they had to bury it in about 50 feet of dirt because it was literally a river of mercury. Mm. He went mad. But it was a demonstration of the belief at the time, centuries ago, that heavy metals like mercury were healing. And so what they've done, and there are scientific studies to show, both in India and in the United States, that a lot of Ayurvedic medicines contain heavy metals, and it's not a mistake. They're purposely put in there. And so one must be careful. And I've got patients, and this is not speaking against any culture other than just trying to bring the best of science. I have a lot of contacts and references even from doctors from India who would say the same thing.
And you cited approximately one in five of these herbs have that issue.
Exactly.
I'm not sure what an Ayurvedic supplement is. Can you give us some examples?
They're part of Ayurvedic medicine, which is involved in the Hindu and intimately involved in the Hindu tradition of part of the healing process. And so there are a number of herbs that fit into that category. When I normally sit down and study those, I can come up with them, but for some reason I just don't have one right at the top of my mind right now. I apologize.
Are they typically going to have Indian names?
No, where they're going to come from is really names of plants that are commonly found in India that have been used as part of that healing process. And I apologize that I'm just drawing a blank right now.
Now, for the average person, I gather that if they were to just take one supplement, which you would have them take would be a very good combination multivitamin, mineral, and phytonutrient supplement.
Right. And the reason for that is a lot of people don't understand the concept. If I can just explain this a little bit, there's just been so much confusion over the statement that if you would just eat a well-balanced diet, you don't need a multivitamin. Can I explain that a little bit?
Yes, please.
Most people don't know where that came from, and it comes from the medical and scientific community, and it's related to the fact of meeting minimums such as RDA. We refer to it as RDI now, but it used to be called RDA, recommended dietary allowances. And most people don't even know where that came from. Well, if you go a little bit further back, it came from World War II. And during World War II, when we were sending out food relief, we didn't want to also send food that was going to give nutritional deficiencies to our soldiers and to food relief in countries. So the government said, well, you need this amount of nutrient, for example, vitamin C, to prevent scurvy, and you need this amount to prevent beriberi and rickets, etc., for prevention of deficiency diseases, and that's how it was designed. Well, most people don't understand that what we're not dying of today, vastly, in most industrialized nations, are deficiency diseases. We're dying of chronic diseases, and the amount of nutrients necessary to reduce the risk of a chronic disease is different than the amount of nutrients necessary to prevent a deficiency disease. So doctors are saying, really, if you just eat a well-balanced diet, you can prevent a deficiency disease. But that's not what I'm scared of. I'm concerned about chronic diseases, so I'd recommend that someone take a good multivitamin to make sure they have not only enough to prevent a deficiency disease, but also arm their immune system, protect their health, reduce inflammation so that they can reduce the risk of chronic disease as well.
Why haven't governmental organizations like the FDA caught up with that and changed their standards?
It's a slow process. I'm very respectful of those organizations because they also want to be very protective. And I think where the supplement industry and people who are interested in supplements have shot themselves in the foot by going to wild extremes and not having science behind what they do. And so in not having science, they're in essence putting themselves into a position where the government doesn't respect their stand. And so they've been so polarized that nobody's listening. I do have to hand it, though, to the Institute of Medicine and the FDA, where the whole concept of RDI was really designed to move from deficiency diseases to, let's expand this concept to be inclusive of other disease concepts, for example, vitamin D. And that's being renewed right now and looked at right now as to, well, what levels should we have for vitamin D? But it's like moving a huge ship, understandably so, because you want to get the agreement of hundreds, if not thousands, of respected people around the world to all agree with you, which is very difficult to do. So they're moving in that direction, but they're just moving slowly.
In some ways, it sounds like a lesson in capitalism, in that if you come up with a new drug and you patent it, you can charge a premium price for it. But if you're selling vitamin D, put a lot of research into it, your competitors are going to sell it for less.
Well, you know, I'm sure finance has a tendency to have to speak in a lot of different arenas of our life. I don't understand those arenas. I don't understand politics. I'm just someone who's just simply trying to get the information of how people can protect themselves out there with a rational voice.
In the trade-off between not spending any more than we have to on a supplement versus getting a good quality supplement, what do you look for in a supplement?
Well, I honestly think that the best supplements, and there are many fine manufacturers around the world and in the U.S., and I think the finest, of course, are going to be ones that truly come from plants. I think they're going to reach certain nutrient levels, you need to put in some synthetics to get up to certain levels that research has shown to be beneficial. But ideally, instead of having everything be synthetic, it'd be great to have something that really is a condensed plant as much as you can, and have those plants grown organically, ideally, so that there aren't a lot of herbicides and pesticides, and a supplement that is going to have rational levels. One that's not going to say, wow, we want to follow that more is better philosophy, but one that puts in nutrient levels based on some solid science.
Well, that's why I like your idea of starting with a good moldable vitamin, in that if it's well thought out, they're going to balance the different vitamins so that they're in good proportions.
Exactly. You're going to be a little bit more protected that way, for sure.
I gather that if there were just one other supplement that the average person would take, you would have it be a gram a day of omega-3 fatty acid.
You hit it right on the head. That would be the next, because it's interesting that in our society, so many people don't like fish or have gotten away from fish, or we have animals that are fed by grain rather than free-ranged animals. Dr. Artemis Somopoulos, who is someone I'm privileged to know, she wrote the book called The Omega Diet. She talks about how she used to be at the National Institute of Health, and how she did studies on animals that were on her family farm in the Isle of Crete, and she analyzed what those particular animals would naturally free range on. And for example, the chickens would free range and eat purslane, which we in the United States consider a toxic weed, but in other places in the world they don't. Well, she took the purslane back to the National Institute of Health and found that it was really loaded with omega-3. So the eggs of the chickens would have higher levels of omega-3. The meat of the chicken would have higher levels of omega-3. That's why when you talk about the Mediterranean diet, it's much more than just vegetables, olive oil, and fish oil. It really translated to also the meat that they took in were free-ranged animals, et cetera, originally, but would have higher levels of omega-3.
And one of the subtle messages in your book is that nutrition and supplements are just enormously complex and interrelated, and there's just far more vitamins and enzymes and things than scientists are even aware of at this point. An awful lot of the supplements are going to miss a lot of these subtleties and ingredients that we're not even aware of.
Exactly. In fact, the whole field of nutrigenomics, which I've had the privilege of being around some of the people who are extremely knowledgeable with this new science, where we've known for years that, you know, this 10 different people could eat the same diet and look differently. That's, in essence, your genetic influence on the dietary intake. Well, what nutrigenomics is that the food we take in not only is absorbed into our bloodstream, but it actually, and is not only is it the nutrients absorbed into the cell, but those nutrients get into where the DNA is, and it can actually turn on and turn off certain genes. And the amount of information now that we're starting to understand, I happen to be with some of the leaders in this field with our associations and their understanding, but it is incredibly complex. And all of the recommendations that are in the book are in with those considerations in mind.
I got the impression that the gene part is kind of not quite ready for prime time yet, but 10 years from now, it'll start becoming extremely important in medicine and annual checkups and those kind of things.
Well, absolutely. In fact, I really perceive that we're going to be at a point where you can have genetic tests that are done to find out if you have susceptibilities to certain diseases, and then we'll know the nutrients that help turn off those genes. Because a bad gene, or any gene, is like a light switch in a house. The gene isn't always turned on. You can turn on and turn off the gene based on your lifestyle. Well, we know, for example, that the gene associated commonly with MS is affected by vitamin D. Now, reasonable levels of, if people who are vitamin deficient in vitamin D have a tendency to have that gene turned on, but if they have rational, reasonable levels of vitamin D, that gene has a tendency to be turned off. So I think that is just one example of a vast amount of information we're going to know in the next decade or so.
It reminds me of computers, that there are enormous amounts of things you could do to make changes in it, but you have to know what you're doing.
You're darn right. And sometimes a little bit of knowledge can be really dangerous. You can blow that hard. That's why the steps that we take, I want to take steps that are careful, that have some good science to them. And when people will bring things up, I'd rather say, you know what, let me look into that rather than jumping on board, because you've hit on a perfect point. A little bit of knowledge can be dangerous, and we have to be careful.
I want to go back to omega-3s for a minute, because I was so excited when you talked about caloric restriction. Tell us how that fits with omega-3s.
Well, one of the benefits of caloric restriction is, in essence, its effect on micronutrients within our bodies and that are associated with longevity. And omega-3 has a tendency to impact those same micronutrients in the exact same way. There is a distinct potential from some preliminary research that all of the benefits that have been touted for decades on extreme dietary restriction leading to longevity may be achieved equally by taking adequate amounts of omega-3. That's not to say that you can eat unbelievable amounts of food and take a few omega-3 tablets, which is what the natural tendency of the average American is to assume. But if we eat a good diet, which is a vast amount of what comes in, we're rational and reasonable with our caloric intake, and we take omega-3, all the benefits of caloric restriction may be related similarly to what omega-3 can do.
Which is wonderful, because not many of us are going to eat 1,600 calories a day and on any ongoing basis.
Or less. I mean, there are some people, there is some research that what they've done on mice, that they're recommending amounts of intake that are much, much less than that. And most people don't stay on it because it's just so restrictive that they're tired, they're thin, they don't have the nutrients in their normal food to be able to protect them in a lot of different ways, which really kind of doesn't make sense.
Before we run out of time, I want to make sure we get in stress. And your take on stress is that it's not so objectively, you know, like make a list and give you so many points for buying a new house and so many points for getting a divorce or marriage, but that is the things that you value and the things that you want to achieve with your life. Do they match the way that you spend your time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, everyone that I meet everywhere in the world, there isn't a country where stress that's industrialized that doesn't have stress. That's just part of being an industrialized society. Whether you're from China or India or South Africa or Germany, it doesn't make any difference. If your country is industrialized, you're a stressed individual. And what I was finding, and even in my own life, that I would say certain things were important in my life, but in reality, I was actually living not according to what I believed. So it kind of struck me one day that let me write down the things that caused me the greatest stress, and let me write down also the things that are most important to me, and what I found is that they were the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so most research that I'd looked at, people would say, well, the way to handle stress is to get away from it. Well, that didn't make any sense to me, because now that I had my two lists, what they're asking me to do in whatever form they advise, they're asking me to get away from the most important things in my life,
mm-hmm.
which isn't going to work. And so what I realized, my problem with why these areas were a stress in my life, is that I hadn't made a priority list and kept to it and lived accordingly. And so I even asked my wife, I go, you know, honey, do you think number one is number one on my list? And she goes, well, I know you want it to be, but it really is not. So it took me actually months to change things to help my life correspond with my list.
I think that's a wonderful take on stress and what to do about it. For a layperson, in addition to reading The Optimal Health Revolution, what newsletters or other sources would keep us up to date on what's happening on how to be healthy?
I have a tendency to lean more in the direction of the ones that are associated with universities, per se. Tufts University, the University of Berkeley, both of those have quite rational, reasonable newsletters. I don't agree with everything they say because, again, there's going to be a little bit of a biased perspective, but yet at the same time, they've got a lot of good, solid scientific information in there that I think is good. And then also the Center for Science and the Public Interest, they have a newsletter that has some really good information about food components and nutrient components that I think is quite valuable as well.
We're talking with Dr. Duke Johnson, author of The Optimal Health Revolution, a wonderful book for integrating how to stay healthy and explaining how it all ties together with avoiding inflammation. The website is drdukejohnson.com. And Dr. Johnson is also the medical director for Nutrilite, that's Nutrilite.com. And the website for Nutrilite is just Nutrilite.com. Dr. Johnson, thank you so much for sharing with us, and you're really nailing it.
Dr. Bricky, thank you so much for having this time and your interest shown in me in the book, and I just really appreciate our time together. Thank you very much.
Oh, one more comment. I mentioned earlier that Nutrilite is a subsidiary of Amway. Optimal Health, I read the whole book and didn't see Amway anywhere in it. I didn't even know that there was an association until I went to the Nutrilite website. You tell me the only place it's mentioned is in the dedication. So it's not a promotion for Amway. It's a book that just stands on its own and talks about how to be healthier.
Well, absolutely, because I'm not representing company in the book, or they're really the opinions of a physician, because what I can do is I can talk about the science and how nutrients affect our health. Couldn't do it if I'm really referring to products or representing the company per se, which I don't want to cross any lines legally. I don't want to do anything wrong. I just simply want to present to people what my perception has been and what we've been able to find from research and our experiences with a global audience, and pass that on to protect people. That's my greatest passion right there. So if people want to get their nutrients elsewhere, by all means, there are several good manufacturers. I just want to get the truth out.
And I also forgot to mention that not only do you do research about health practices in dozens of countries, but you also lecture not only in the United States, but all over the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I was in China last year, recently in Italy. I'm going to be going to Malaysia real soon, back to Italy real soon. Yeah, I'm kind of a global traveler, that's for sure.
You've got your frequent flyer miles, huh?
You bet. You bet I do.
Dr. Johnson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Commentary. Most health and wellness gurus and authors emphasize their niche or try to be comprehensive and cover both diet and exercise. Dr. Johnson, or Dr. Duke as he often is called, presents a very holistic approach with avoiding inflammation as a key integrating concept. His holistic approach not only addresses diet and exercise, but also supplements, sleep, stress, water, air quality, and many other factors. In interviews, I try to focus on what is most unique about an expert and their area of greatest expertise. Consequently, time did not permit going into all of his issues and recommendations. To recap Dr. Johnson's big picture, a century ago, most Americans died from an acute illness. Today, modern medicine can prevent or cure most acute illnesses. We also are better educated, more informed, and have more money to take care of ourselves. Consequently, it is the chronic diseases like cardiovascular disease, cancer, and diabetes that kills most Americans. In the last decade, researchers are increasingly converging on inflammation as the common denominator of most chronic diseases. We also are seeing a convergence on the Mediterranean diet. Thus, Dr. Johnson's comments on how few people in Mediterranean countries are really following that diet is an important heads up. We need to be following the principles of the Mediterranean diet and not the way it's currently practiced in most Mediterranean countries. Of course, we are also seeing a convergence on the importance of exercise, both cardiovascular and strength, and I might add flexibility and balance. Most researchers also give a passing nod to the importance of stress. I really like the way Dr. Johnson not only underscores stress, but instead of just talking about trying to reduce stress, ties it to your sense of purpose and whether your use of time fits with your values and purpose. To cite a few of the experts Ageless Lifestyles has interviewed, Dr. Barry Sears, especially in his newest book, Toxic Fat, focused on inflammation in the Mediterranean diet and omega-3 fats to prevent inflammation. Cardiologist Dr. Joel Ochner and cardiopsychologist Dr. Jerry Corafine emphasized both the Mediterranean diet and a big emphasis on stress. And cardiologist Dr. Michael Osner also focused on the Mediterranean diet, exercise, and dealing well with stress. Some takeaways from today are to at least once include C-reactive protein test in your next annual physical, avoid high fructose corn syrup, and choose whole grain over multigrain. Dr. Johnson said for the average person, if they were only to take two supplements, it should be a very high quality multivitamin that includes minerals and other common supplements so that you get a balance of the things often missed in a diet, and omega-3 fatty acids. I heartily concur. I also note that Dr. Johnson in his book recommended investing in a whole house water filter. I heartily agree. Including the plumbing bill, this should set you back about $600 and about $15 a month for filters and charcoal material. A very good investment. Baby steps. I always try to leave listeners with a little tweak in their behavior or lifestyle that helps them live longer, healthier, and happier, the objectives of our show. This time, I'm going to actually suggest three baby steps. One is to include a C-reactive protein test in your next annual physical. Two is to avoid high fructose corn syrup. And three is to choose whole grain as opposed to multigrain breads. Emails. I love getting emails. Send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. That's radio@agelesslifestyles.com. The most common response I got to our most recent show with Dr. Osner on how research indicates that cardiac bypass surgery and even angioplasties and stents are no more effective than conservative medical treatment in reducing heart attacks and reducing death rates. The question was, how can cardiologists continue to do so many of these procedures when the research doesn't support it? I would suggest four factors. First, medicine is very protocol-driven, and once there is a protocol that indicates this is what you should do in this situation, medical boards, hospitals, lawsuits punish doctors who don't follow the protocol. Thus, it's very risky to go outside of the usual protocols and do more conservative treatment. Further, the bypass and stent industry is very lucrative, not only for the surgical equipment suppliers and the hospitals, but of course for the cardiologist as well. And finally, we patients are to blame in that we want the doctors to do something. Now, what we'd really like is a pill that solves all our problems, but if we can't get a pill to solve all our problems, then we want surgery. The last thing we want is to have to change our diet and exercise. I love hearing from you. Just send those emails to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. This is your anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricky. If you'd like to get my free email newsletter, the Defy Aging newsletter, you can just go to drbricky.com, that's drbricke.com, or my portal site, notaging.com. There you can also find information on my Oprah featured book, Defy Aging, on my shorter book, 52 Baby Steps to Grow Young, and my very unique anti-aging hypnosis CDs, and my speaking services. Our next show will be on boomeritis, baby boomer crises when they hit middle age. Until next show, this is your anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricky, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.